Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday here on Mind Talk. Thoughtful Thursday is the day every week when you and I have the opportunity to meet with an expert who is graciously willing to share his or her expertise with us. Today's guest is Dr. Elizabeth Schaff. Dr. Schaff, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, Dr. Schaff is an educational and legal consultant. She specializes in the families of sexual and gender minorities. So we'll ask her what that means in a moment. She is the CEO and Director of Legal Services at the Schaff Consulting Group in Atlanta, which is a think tank of experts specializing in unconventional and underserved populations. So Dr. Schaff, I have to ask you to explain what it is you specialize in.
So sex and gender minorities are people who are unconventional somehow or not in the majority. So we used to think of them just as people in same-sex relationships, like gays and lesbians. But there's been an explosion of all sorts of alternative sex and gender identities, everything from transgender folks being much more recognizable with the kind of splash of Caitlyn Jenner on the scene, as well as people who identify as something else besides gay, lesbian, or heterosexual. So bisexual, pansexual, quadsexual, demisexual, there's a million terms out there for the wide diversity of sex and gender identities people have now.
And so with the consulting group, and you are the director of legal services, tell us how that comes into play.
Well, sometimes people with unconventional sex or gender identities, other people feel uncomfortable about them parenting. They feel, for instance, that a transgender person would not be an appropriate parent because they might somehow infect their child with transgenderness, which both assumes that it's catching and that it's a bad thing to be transgendered, that you have to somehow be protected from that. So that kind of assumption of malice and negativity shapes sometimes, usually it's other family members that try to take away custody of a child, like a grandparent will say, oh, I don't want my grandchild raised in this setting. Or sometimes it's another parent. If there's a divorce or some kind of disagreement, one parent will say, I don't want my kid raised like this. The other parent will say, this kid is fine. And so I actually, with training, I can come in and look at a home or a situation, and I can distinguish between homes that are truly problematic or parents that are truly not in the best interest of the children versus a situation that's just unconventional, might not be the norm that people are used to, but is actually just fine for the children, not harming them at all. So being able to tell the difference between those two things is actually crucial when you're considering removing someone's child from their custody.
So it sounds like you work with a number of attorneys, as well as the attorney's clients may come to you first, or the attorney may come to you first. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. And what is the contact information? What is there a website for the Schaff Consulting Group?
Yes, it's elisabethschaff.com.
Okay.
ElisabethSchaff.com.
All right. Before we close out today.
And I can send you a link for that.
That would be great. As I was going to say, before we close out today, I will ask you to repeat it towards the end of the program. But let's talk about your book, The Polyamorous Next Door. This is the result of a significant amount of research and is interwoven with your own personal story. Is that a fair description?
Yes, the book actually reports on my 15-year study of polyamorous families with children, and it was my first book that came out in 2014. It does have some of my own story in it, just because that my story is emblematic, kind of what happens when polyamory goes wrong. But for the vast majority of the book, it's focused on my respondents, or the 133 people that I interviewed over 15 years.
So it is a well-researched document where you talk to real people living in their real lives, experiencing their real world.
Absolutely. And check in with them over time to see what they think as their lives continue and their relationships shift and change, like real relationships do.
Exactly.
And checking in with kids as they grow up and their understanding of their families becomes more sophisticated.
Interesting. Well, you do make the point very early on in your book that polyamorous are, now I'm quoting, your bankers, your IT specialists, your teachers, your dentists, they love their children, they still owe on their student loans, and they could probably stand to lose a few pounds. So in other words, the person who is the polyamorous is just like the person who isn't in terms of what's important to them, the work they do. It's not this foreign entity from another planet.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it.
The difference, though, and indeed you acknowledge that it is a complicated difference, is that with these folks, they've made the decision to have multiple romantic partners at the same time and with each other's consent. So this
Absolutely. This
is not somebody is cheating on their spouse and nobody knows.
Right. That's a big difference between polyamory and cheating, is that cheating is not consensual. It's not negotiated. Instead, it's clandestine and keeps someone in the dark. There's usually one person in a cheating relationship who thinks they're in a monogamous relationship, who's often acting monogamously, if that's the word we can coin.
It's perfectly fine. It's coined, official.
And then another person who has often the power of being sneaky, you know, and pretending to do something they're not, and kind of pulling the wool over their partner's eyes, which is not at all what polyamorists are about. The poly folks want everything out in the open. They want to be honest, and they want to talk about, for instance, safer sex agreements. If you're cheating, you can't bring up safer sex with your partner, because let's say you've been married for 10 years, and then all of a sudden you're like, honey, I think we should use condoms. Honey's going to be upset about that. Honey's going to say, wait a minute, we've been married for 10 years, and all of a sudden, you think we should use condoms? What's going on here?
Exactly.
Whereas in a polyamorous relationship, people can just right out front openly negotiate using condoms, which actually turns out to have a lower rate of sexually transmitted transmission. People are much less likely to infect each other if they're in a polyamorous relationship versus if they're in a cheating relationship.
That's really interesting.
So poly relationships are safer for your sexual health than cheating.
Now that sounds like a t-shirt. The study that you did, again, it was 15 years with the families and with the children, but you also, as I said earlier, you interweave your personal story in with your research and in with your research subject. So I'd like to ask you about your personal story. I mean, you clearly state that polyamory was not on your radar in the beginning.
Right. I actually met this person when I was 22. I met this man who told me on our very first date that he didn't want to be monogamous and he never wanted to get married. And at the time, I was not taking him seriously as a potential life mate. You know, I was very young. I was in college. I was thinking I was going to be a lesbian and was kind of dabbling with him or with any man. I was like, men are disposable, whatever, you know, I'm going to just have fun with this guy until I get back to real relationships with women. And then when I fell in love with him, I realized that it was suddenly a very big deal to me that he never wanted to be monogamous and never wanted to get married. But he did want to be my lifelong partner, and he wanted to be together and have kids and things like that. And I was just like, I don't understand. How do we be together as partners with no marriage or monogamy? Like, what does that even look like? What are you talking about, dude? And so I started looking for people doing that to figure out how they did it. Because the truth is, when he said to me that he never wanted to be monogamous, I heard, you're too fat and you're bad in bed, which is actually something a lot of people hear, not necessarily specifically that you're too fat or you're too bad in bed, but somehow you are not adequate. A lot of people whose partners say, I want to try polyamory or I want to have an open relationship or be non-monogamous somehow, a lot of the partners who hear that think, what's wrong with me that I'm not enough for you? And sometimes it is a lack in the home relationship, but most of the time, it's not a lack. If someone is polyamorous, bisexual orientation, they are never going to be comfortable in a monogamous relationship, much like someone who's monogamous, bisexual orientation, will never be comfortable in a polyamorous relationship.
All right. Now, when you say polyamorous or monogamous bisexual orientation, it sounds like you're saying something different from what people often imagine who even think about having a polyamorous relationship. Talk about that this is a sexual orientation. So this is not something that they got up and chose one day necessarily. This is just how they were born. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying for some people,
okay,
that is absolutely the case. For some people, it is a choice. It's a relationship style that they can try or not. They can do for a while and then do something else or just check it out. And some people, for whom it is a style or a choice, choose to be polyamorous for years and years. For some of my other respondents, they talk about trying really hard to be monogamous and how it just never felt right to them. Some of them talk about it like they're trying to wear a pair of shoes that are three sizes too small, that they can smush their foot in there for a little while and maybe even hobble around for a little bit, but it's never going to be comfortable, and they certainly won't be able to wear those shoes very long. They're going to need to take them off pretty quick. Monogamy can feel that same level of suffocating restriction for people who are polyamorous by orientation, they talk about being hardwired that way, that they were never like, for instance, they never had one best friend when they were growing up. They would always hang out with groups of friends, or even as children, they never pictured themselves getting married to one person. You know, when they would play family, play house as a small child, they would play multiple partner house. They would be marrying the stuffed bear and Barbie and Ken and the unicorn.
Now, you and I both know that if that's the kind of play that a child is engaged in, at least some parents are going to flip their tops and rush that child off to therapy.
Yes, which is unfortunate. We've seen that a lot more, actually, with transgender children. Parents realizing their child is not conventionally gendered, doesn't want to wear the clothes that other children of their gender wear or do the things, or might even say, I may look like a girl, but I'm really a boy, or something like that. And in some cases, parents do try what some people have called reparative therapy, gender confirmation therapy, where they try to kind of remold that child into a conventional gender that fits their assigned gender at birth.
Which is kind of a horrific experience for those kids.
It's
awful. Yeah.
And leads to much higher rates of depression, alcoholism or drug addiction, and suicide, versus parents who allow their child to be whatever gender the child feels like they are on the inside. Those children actually have far superior outcomes in terms of healthy self-image, positive interactions with peers, much better than the children who have been tried to be forced back into a box that doesn't fit them.
You know,
that just does not end well.
I always find it so interesting when we as a people take a behavior or a concept or a belief system and try to find a positive spin to put on it, when in fact it's a very harmful approach to whatever it is. You know, with reparative therapy, I mean, who doesn't want to be repaired in some way? On the other hand, what's wrong with that person that they need to be repaired, and what are the steps that they take to do the repairing? I mean, it's we live in an interesting world.
Absolutely. And we also live in a world where gender is a lot more fluid than it used to be, and people used to be very afraid for their gender unconventional children. But now it looks like if you allow them from the very beginning to shape their gender as they wish, that they turn out just fine. Their peers accept them, they find partners, they find love and joy in their lives and in themselves. So I think as a whole, actually, we are, in this society, at least in the U.S., really beginning to realize that gender expression that comes from the inside does not always have to match what the body looks like on the outside, and that you can change your body to be more comfortable with how you feel like you are on the inside.
Now, we know that there are parents, there would be friends, there are all kinds of people who will express fear for the way that person will be accepted in the world, whether they're straight or gay, transgendered, in a poly relationship. I mean, you know, the list goes on. And so they will say that from their sense of knowing how cruel the world can be, they want the person to be something that they would see as more quote-unquote normal. So what do you say to those folks?
I would say that the cost of trying to pretend you're something different than you are, be that monogamous or cisgendered. Cisgender means feeling like you are the same gender that you were assigned at birth. So, for instance, I'm a cisgendered woman, meaning when I was born, they assigned me female gender, and that feels right to me. Like, I've never felt like there was something off between my body and what I feel like on the inside. It all matches for me, so I'm cisgendered.
Okay.
But if I were transgendered, then trying to pretend that I was cisgendered actually comes at such a significant cost. Blending in can be, or attempting to blend in when it really doesn't fit, can be far more painful than simply facing some peer discomfort for a while. Many transgender folks, or polyamorous folks, or, you know, people with unconventional sexual identities of any sort, or gender identities, can really find others in their same group, and find social acceptance, find love, you know, find really a very satisfying life. It may be challenging, certainly, especially coming out initially or transitioning from one thing to something else can be very difficult and painful, but far less difficult or painful than trying to live a lie for your entire life.
Well, that is absolutely a painful experience, and not really living, I would suggest. Dr. Scheff, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with today's conversation. Dr. Scheff, as we continue our conversation about polyamory, I'm wondering if you have a sense of how common this experience is, at least in the United States. Is this a tiny percentage of people, or something different?
You know, ironically, that's a really difficult question to answer because there is no census. There's no official count of the number of polyamorous people, and even people who identify themselves as polyamorous don't necessarily agree on the definition of polyamory. So it's hard to say exactly what it is, and it's hard to count. One thing is very clear, though, that people are reconsidering monogamy as the only way to go. So people are having either serial monogamous relationships where they're monogamous with one person for a while until they break up, and then are monogamous with another person for a while until they break up. But more and more people are having varieties of open relationships. So dating other people as a couple, or swinging, or having a partner that share, or having other girlfriends and boyfriends outside of your spouse, or not even committing to a single spouse and having multiple partners, none of whom are your primary partner. So that last thing is called solo polyamory. And a lot of people are just kind of constructing romantic and social lives that fit their needs and desires instead of saying, okay, what's the right way society says to be. So whether or not they identify it as polyamory, kind of call it that specifically, a lot of people are having openly conducted non-monogamous relationships.
Is there...
The estimates I've seen range anywhere in terms of inside the United States, range anywhere from 2 million to 15 million people in the U.S. identifying specifically as polyamorous. But even so, that's a fairly small percentage of people in the U.S. Like, way more people identify as swingers, for instance, than polyamorous.
Well, what is the difference between an open relationship or being swingers and being in a polyamorous relationship?
Open is kind of an umbrella term that doesn't give you much information about the specifics of the relationship, except that it's non-monogamous. Swingers tend to focus on sexual variety, not emotional intimacy with multiple partners. So swingers will often keep emotional intimacy for them and their primary partner, which is sometimes a husband or a wife or something like that, and have casual sex with others, but not allow that casual sex to become an emotional relationship. Whereas, and that's not every single swinger, but in general, that's the kind of tone of swinging communities in the U.S., more focused on casual sex. Polyamorists are focused on more love or finding emotional connection among multiple people. And sometimes that includes sex, and sometimes it doesn't. But it certainly doesn't put the primary emphasis on sex and sexual variety the way swinging does. In fact, polyamorists tell me when I ask them about their relationships in my research, they tell me that they end up not having all that much sex all the time because they spend so much time talking about their feelings and negotiating who's going to hang out with the kids while the other person is away for the weekend. Or, you know, they spend so much time talking that sometimes they're too tired to have sex afterwards.
I'm going to leave that one alone. Let's go back to your brush, if you will, with polyamory. You fell madly in love with someone who made it very clear, this is not what I want to do. But as you realized you were in love, you figured there was nothing else to do until you began to research. What did you ultimately decide to do with the love of your life?
Boy, that's a rough question. We talked about polyamory for a long time, and first we didn't even know the word. When he brought it up with me initially, we didn't have a word for it until I heard about the word polyamory and then looked it up online and found people in our area who were having a meeting about it. So we went to that meeting, and initially I wasn't even thinking about researching it at all. I was thinking, how do you people do this? You know, I'm freaked out about this. And it wasn't until, just as an intellectual, I tend to intellectualize things that frighten me. If I can understand them, they seem somehow less threatening.
As do a lot of people.
And actually, it does feel less threatening mm-hmm. to me now that I understand it better. But it never it never actually worked with he and I. He was very focused on wanting another woman to join us. So we didn't know the term at the time, but we were unicorn hunters, that we were looking for a bisexual woman to kind of come and join our relationship kind of on our terms. And we didn't, a lot of couples do that. We didn't really think that much about how that would feel for her or what that would be like for her. We had a lot of, he especially had a lot of ideas about what it would be like for us. I was very reluctant, and he kept talking and talking and talking about it. For about 10 years, we talked about it probably 3 to 5 times a week. And so I was just so sick of the conversation. I said, dude, go get yourself a girlfriend. I am so sick of this. Just go do it. Shut up about it and go do it. And then suddenly he was like, oh, this is harder than I thought. There wasn't the kind of line of women lining up to hook up with him, and there were a lot more people interested in me, not just women but men too. When a man fell in love with me and then I fell in love with that man, my long-term male partner could not handle it. He freaked out and suddenly was like, oh, I think we should be monogamous and get married. And I was so angry.
Wait a minute now. Wait a minute. Mr. Polyamory himself.
Exactly.
All of a sudden.
And ironically, it happens a lot that way, that people think polyamory is going to be one way and they develop this big fantasy about it. And then when they actually try it, it's not what they thought it was going to be. So sometimes it's much better. Like, I thought I would be jealous and uncomfortable, and I wasn't. When he did hook up with other people, I was surprised at how not upset about it I was. It was fine for me. He thought he would not be jealous, and he turned out to be incredibly jealous. So it surprised us both.
Interesting.
I tried to stay with him. I tried really hard. I stopped seeing the other man that I was in love with great resentment, I have to say, against my primary partner. We even moved to a different state to try to patch things up, and it just didn't work. I couldn't forgive him for what felt like manipulating me and lying to himself about what he wanted, because it came at such great cost to me. So I tried to get over it for 5 years, and then ultimately I left him because I didn't feel like I could trust him, and I didn't feel like we could move past what had happened with us.
So you were with him for a total of 15 years?
Yes.
That's a long time to be struggling with what the relationship is going to be tomorrow.
Yes, it was. It was incredibly exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if we hadn't had children already, when he told me, oh, it's a man that wants you, well, I think we should be monogamous and get married, I would have left him that night. I would have gone home and packed up my stuff, and he never would have seen me again. But we had 2 small kids, and I didn't feel, I mean, even though I was incredibly angry at him, I felt like I owed those children to try to work it out with their dad, try as hard as I could, and I did. I tried everything. We tried counseling, which was actually really effective, helped a lot. Couples counseling and personal counseling and psychotropic medication and herbal medicines and exercise and hypnotherapy and aromatherapy. And it was when I realized that I was moving on to alcohol and sedation was my next step of trying to stay with him. was I was just going to start drinking heavily, I was like, that's not going to be a good environment for these children if their mom becomes an embittered alcoholic to stay with their dad. So that's when I left.
And it wouldn't have been good for you either.
No, no. But it was, I mean, the whole, if I were only thinking about myself, I would have left him much sooner. But I really felt like I wanted to try to make it work for the kids.
Interesting. And today, are you in a polyamorous relationship today?
You know, if you had asked me earlier this week, I would have said no. Now I'm not totally sure. My wife and I have been in a monogamish relationship where both of us have the option to hook up with other people outside of our relationship, and we just haven't much at all. But she recently met someone who has caught her fancy, and we're actually having lunch with that person this weekend, and I'm not totally sure what's happening with that, what that's going to turn into. So I guess the answer to that is stay tuned, and we'll find out.
So the two of you are going to have lunch with this person?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have chatted with her on Facebook a little bit. We're both academicians. All three of us, in fact, are academicians. And so we have a lot of publishing, study, sociology things to talk about. We have a lot in common. So we'll see. I actually felt fine when my wife went and spent the weekend with her recently. I wasn't exactly sure how that was going to go for me, and it was kind of a nothing. It wasn't a big deal to me at all, which surprises me. I keep thinking, am I going to be upset about this? And it keeps not happening. It's not like I'm planning not to get freaked out about it. It's just not in there. So what I think we might end up as, which who knows if this will be the true case, in a polymono relationship potentially, with her being polyamorous and me being monogamous, because my sex drive is not that high, which has been a little bit of an issue for she and I, that she has a much higher sex drive than I do. And sometimes I feel guilty that I'm not meeting her needs. So for her to get her higher sex drive needs met with me and then someone else too, I don't feel as guilty because she's getting her needs met more. But I don't, my low-ish sex drive doesn't mean that I don't crave connection. I end up getting just a ton of my needs met through friendship. I have very emotionally intimate and satisfying friendships, and that works for me. I call that emotional connection, polyaffective, and have found out through my research that it's those non-sexual connections between and among people kind of connected through the same polyamorous relationship that are actually the glue that keeps a polyamorous family together. The sexual variety can be, fun and interesting for people, but much like monogamous relationships that need something more than just great sex to make them last over time, it's that emotional connection between and among multiple adults and children that actually gives the polyamorous family its resilience.
You made reference to the fact that the three of you are all in the same field. We're going to take a break now, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up with who exactly engages in polyamorous relationships, at least based on your research?
Sounds great.
All right. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Dr. Elizabeth Sheff, who is the author of The Polyamorous Next Door. We'll be right back. Dr. Sheff, who are the folks who are engaged in polyamorous relationships? So far, we think we kind of know about three academics.
Right. And actually, that very high level of education is characteristic of people in polyamorous relationships, or at least people who participate in research about polyamory. And I need to point out that those are probably two different populations. The people who simply have non-monogamous relationships and are leading their lives versus the people who are willing to talk to researchers about them. The people who participate in research tend to be incredibly highly educated. Many of them are white and middle or upper middle class, in part because those are the people who are safe in their lives to talk to researchers. People who are employed by, let's say, Chick-fil-A or something, a conservative organization. If you're the manager of a Chick-fil-A and your upper boss finds out that you're polyamorous, you come out or someone outs you, the chance that you will lose your job is very high. So people with high levels of education who are computer programmers or physicians or university professors or things like that are safer to come out because they're much less likely to lose their job over it. And they can probably afford a lawyer if someone challenges their custody of their children versus someone who's, you know, maybe working at the Gap or something, and someone challenges their custody of their children, they might not be able to fight that without a lawyer. So it's much safer for people with social privilege, specifically race and class privilege, to be open about being a polyamorous person. I don't think that that means that people without race and class privilege are not polyamorous. I think those folks are also having open relationships or multiple partner relationships, but they might not be either calling it polyamory, or they might not feel safe enough to participate in research about it. And I'm actually very, very careful with the people who participate in my research. I'm very careful to protect their identities and not out them as polyamorous. But it does increase the risk. Once you start telling people that you're polyamorous, someone else might hear about it. Or, for instance, people going to polyamorous events, conferences or meetups or things like that. You know, what if someone sees them? If their grandmother and mother and cousin all go to the same church and their grandmother's best friend sees them at this polyamorous conference or something, word's going to get out at church. And what if that costs them their connection to their family of origin? For white, well-off people, if their family rejects them, it's not, I mean, it's a big deal emotionally, but it doesn't necessarily devastate their lives because they still have social acceptance. Born of white skin gives you a ton of white privilege in society versus people of color or working class people potentially with kind of fewer social privileges to fall back on. It can be much more dangerous, much more costly for them because they have less in reserve, less social privilege or less social acceptance that they can count on. So actually my newest book is When Someone You Love is Polyamorous, and that's designed, that book is much shorter than my first or second book, actually, and is designed to help people come out as polyamorous to their families and kind of give their families or loved ones or children or partners or whoever, give them a sense of what polyamory is and answer some questions about it so they hopefully don't get so upset and try to take custody or make it into a legal issue.
I'm wondering if it's a race and class issue, or if it's more of a class issue. Have you had experience with talking with persons of color who are at a reasonably high economic level who are engaged in polyamorous relationships?
I have, and they talk about the politics of respectability that, especially for African-American people, and I've done a lot of that research here in Atlanta, which has a sizable middle-class and upper-middle-class African-American population, one of the biggest in the nation, I think. And those folks talk about how much judgment society has against especially black people, and how they feel like as a black professional or as an upper middle class black person that they need to constantly kind of be on their guard for other people's assumptions about them, especially white people, and how doing things that look not respectable on some level, they're worried that that would reaffirm whites' assumptions about them, the stereotypical assumptions about black sexuality that is kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Voracious. Black sexuality has been portrayed by white people as out of control, as somehow like especially poignant or especially potent. And so the politics of respectability, especially for middle-class black people, is that they don't want to do anything that gives white people an excuse to look down on them. So they're very concerned about polyamory being like a not a respectable, kind of a gross white person thing to do.
So it gets to be, as complicated as it is, it gets to be even more complicated if you are of color, particularly African American, or I can think of a lot of other racial experiences where this would likely be just as complicated.
Right. Like I imagine in Texas or California with a very high Latino population, that there are similar white people making up stories about hot Latinas or something, you know, how those hot-blooded Latin folks have all this crazy sexuality that white people don't have access to or something. And that's one of the things when people of color are polyamorous. They talk about being a little nervous in social situations when it looks like people want to date them or want to have a fling with them only because of the novelty of their race, that feels very objectifying to them, and they're not comfortable with it. So there have, just within the last 10 years, I would say, there have started to be organizations specifically for poly people of color who are more comfortable with each other, that they're not going to objectify each other necessarily the way they're afraid that white people might objectify them.
So it really makes sense then for them to have groups that are very, that are supportive of them and sort of their path in life in a way that whites may not need to have that same affirmation or acceptance, because they've got acceptance and affirmations in other areas.
Right, yes.
Okay.
And
okay.
I need to say, I'm white, and I acknowledge that white privilege gives me not only the ability to be polyamorous or not if I want to, but the safety to research this and talk and think about this in a way that has no implication for other people of my race. People don't look at me and think, oh, that slutty white girl, that must mean all those, see, she's so slutty. We knew that all those white girls were slutty. Whereas people of color are often held up, not just as individuals themselves, but as a stand-in for everyone with that same skin tone. And that's an incredible amount of weight to carry, this social weight of everyone judging you as a representative of your entire race of people.
Indeed.
So it's kind of no wonder that people of color have been more concerned about respectability than white people, because white people set the standards of respectability, and of course they favor us because we're setting them.
So it really sounds like the more that I think about it, it sounds like the numbers are probably significantly greater than what you've been able to discover, just because of the reasons that you just articulated in terms of how others would experience this couple or this individual or this family.
Absolutely. It's just much safer if you're white. You have a lot more access to being unconventional or weird, and people aren't as uncomfortable about it, or they're just not as freaked out by it. When white people do it, it doesn't seem as, it's not emblematic of the entire race, and it doesn't seem as menacing. White people have assigned this really frightening kind of menacing aspect to the sexuality of people of color across the board, or de-sexed them completely. But it's always coming from a white perspective of what white people think of them, rather than this internal perspective of people of color presenting their own sexuality. And that's why I think people of color tend to create their own groups, because it's the sexual expression and the self-expression is just so much safer for them, much less commodified or objectified. Not that people of color don't objectify each other, I'm sure that happens, but white people are famous for objectifying people of color.
It sounds like you've got some more research to do.
Yes, in fact, I'm starting up again. I've done three rounds of research so far, three waves of data collection, and I'm about to start again this fall, talking to people who have grown up in polyamorous families. So I'm doing a speaking tour for my new book, When Someone You Love is Polyamorous, and at the same time, I'm going to be doing focus groups, not at the exact same time. I'll speak,
sure.
And then another day, I'll do a focus group with people who grew up in non-monogamous families, either who are still kids now or who are adults that came from non-monogamous families.
And it does sound like it would be useful to have something done on how the various races and cultures approaching or reacting to folks who are in the range of polyamorous relationships that you describe in your book? If nothing else, but for those folks to affirm that they're not alone.
Absolutely. And I have done some of that research. I have done some interviews about that and read a whole bunch of other people's research. I co-authored an article in 2011 called The Privilege of Perversity, looking at that. And I think as a white researcher, people of color might be less eager to tell me about their lives and relationships just for concerns of judgment about respectability, and might feel more comfortable telling a researcher of color about their experiences.
That's true.
So I am interested in that research, but I might not be the right person to do it.
Probably a conversation for another day.
Yes, possibly so.
And indeed, you know, there is so much that you bring out in your book, The Polyamorous Next Door, and so much that we're not going to have time to get to. One of the things that I did want to ask, and I don't know if it's a quick answer, what is the impact of divorce on polyamorous relationships?
That's a great question, actually. Some people choose polyamory as an alternative to divorce if they feel like, for instance, their differing sexual needs in the same relationship are causing so much friction that the relationship is good in many ways, but they need more sexual expression or different sexual expression to be satisfied, then polyamory can help them stay together and not need to divorce to find that. Help them keep their spouse and have other people too. Some people try polyamory and it doesn't work and they end up divorced, and that was my experience. And some people divorce because monogamy doesn't work for them. So they've been in monogamous relationships that they were not able to sustain the monogamy. And then they divorce, and then they refuse to make monogamous agreements after that. So they divorce from a monogamous for a cheating relationship, and then will only have polyamorous relationships after that and don't make an agreement or sexual exclusivity anymore.
Unfortunately, our time today is gone, but I am going to ask if we can revisit this at some later point. There's so much more to learn.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. And once again, I'm just going to ask you to give your website for folks who would like to get more information right now.
Okay, so it's Elizabeth with an S instead of a Z. ElizabethSheffeff.com.
Terrific. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you can always send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And folks, I want you to always remember, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable.